And there we go. Welcome, everyone. I'm Mike Siggers of SimpleNomics.com. And today we have the distinct pleasure of talking to David Meerman Scott, one of today's thought leaders on viral marketing. Welcome, David.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mike. Thanks for setting this all up.
Glad to do it. And talking about setting it up, this call came about because I wanted to share the technology that we're using with a thought leader of the day and using a teleseminar and an ask campaign. And David was gracious enough to submit to this torture. And today we're going to ask the questions of the people that read your blog, David, and people that read your book, The New Rules of Viral Marketing. They wanted answers. They got some questions. And easily we get to you from Boston, me from Louisville, Kentucky, and them from wherever they're at. We all get to get together and get those questions. How cool is that?
Awesome. It's great.
How many people out there do you think, David, recognize that this campaign, just like we're doing it, is actually a form of viral marketing?
That's a good question. You know, the interesting thing about viral marketing, it's just the concept of spreading your ideas. It's just the concept of getting other people to talk about you and what you're up to. And it can take so many different forms. And when I talk about it, I talk about on the web. Other people sometimes refer to it as word of mouth marketing, which implies as well that it's happening offline. Now, of course, people do talk about products offline with their friends and in bars and what have you, but I sort of focus on the online piece of it. And what you're doing and what we're doing is absolutely a form of viral marketing, because you approached me and said, hey, let's do a little teleseminar, and I'll stick up a little site, and we'll promote it on our blogs and see what happens. And when other people share, that's exactly what happens, is it becomes something that's viral, and it's so interesting to me. And I don't know how many people would think of this as viral, but it is.
Yeah, I think we miss the fact sometimes that all the technologies, especially like the ones that you spoke about in your book, they just merely make it easier for us to tell other people about a product, a service, a brand, or whatever it might be. And I think sometimes people mistakenly think that viral marketing is them using all of those tools to tell everybody about themselves.
Right. Yeah, no, it's all about having other people spread your ideas. And, of course, marketing traditionally and communications traditionally has always been about us marketers and communicators and PR people either telling our story directly or getting sort of the mainstream media, you know, the people who are working at magazines, newspapers, television, radio stations to talk about what we're doing. This is really different. This is the idea of getting people to talk about our ideas, our thoughts, our products and services, even by word of mouth, I call it. So people sharing with friends on their blogs, people emailing their friends and colleagues with interesting links, people posting information on sites and whatnot, which is really different than what we've always focused on as marketers, which is, you know, talking incessantly about our own products and services and trying to coerce people into listening to what we have to say, and then and trying to interrupt them from what they're doing and hopefully get them to pay attention.
You talk to a lot of corporations, businesses about marketing, and especially viral marketing. How many of those people misinterpret viral marketing and actually think that it is them finding new ways for someone else in their company to tell people about them? And how many of them actually comprehend that they're talking about kind of like that venture capital bell curve that you used in the book there?
I think that most of the people that I speak with do understand the basic concepts around viral marketing. I think most people just, you know, they get the idea that they can create something that has a potential to catch on with other people, and that other people would be willing to share with their friends and their colleagues and their family members. But I think what most of the larger companies in particular tend to do is they apply what I call those old rules of marketing to try to create something that goes to go viral. And when I talk about the old rules of marketing, I really I'm talking about two basic concepts. One of those concepts is that people until we had the web, you had to either buy your way in to people's minds by purchasing advertising somewhere. So perhaps a yellow page ad or a magazine or newspaper ad, television, radio, billboards, trade shows, all direct mail are all forms of buying access to other people's, to lists and to other people's media. The other way that people traditionally before the web have tried to reach people is to try to convince the media, mainstream media, magazines, newspapers, television, radio, to write about or broadcast about our products and services. And so these are the skills that have been rewarded traditionally over decades at with people in terms of how they market have been the skills of being really good at advertising, being really good at coercing people to do something, that being really good at interrupting people, and also being really skilled at getting mainstream media to tell our stories for us. And what's so interesting about the web and this whole concept of viral marketing is that that it changed. The whole dynamic changes. It's about creating really interesting pieces of content that people find compelling. They find the pieces of they find the content interesting, outrageous, funny, remarkable, fascinating, very educational. You know, all of these sorts of things are components of it, or any number of them can be components. And as they find these things interesting, they share them. So again, I'm getting back to the question in a convoluted way here, but what happens with traditional marketers is they say, okay, I want to create something to go viral. And they automatically think that they have to apply those old rules to make it work. So they think that they have to buy access somewhere. And you'll see forms of that where somebody will create, and typically a big company, will create something, and then they'll market it with expensive advertising. So, for example, Budweiser created something called Bud TV, and it's something they created to try to have a viral marketing component to it. And the way that they got people to look at these viral videos was they advertised for Bud TV on the Super Bowl and other places like that. So that's sort of a traditional approach of trying to do viral marketing, and it didn't work. The other way is that they'll create a piece of viral, hopefully viral content, and then they'll reach out to traditional media, radio, television, magazines, newspapers, or analysts, and try to get them to spread the story and kick off a seed of a viral marketing campaign. And again, that's using sort of the older rules of trying to approach people. So I do want to pause for a moment and say I'm not anti-old media. I'm not anti-advertising. I think in some cases traditional advertising works, and I think in other cases mainstream media can really be helpful in getting a story quoted in a magazine or newspaper, radio, television is really great. However, I think that we've got a new way to reach people online, and particularly getting creating things that have a potential to go viral, and being able to harness that requires a different way of thinking. So I'm not suggesting that everybody should stop paying attention to mainstream media and never advertise ever again. I am suggesting, however, that to be successful on the web, you need to think like a publisher rather than a marketer. You need to create great content that people want to consume as opposed to trying to coerce and interrupt them.
You used the word remarkable there a minute ago. Is that the key? Is remarkable content, is that the key?
Well, it seems to be a combination of a number of different components, and some remarkable is one of the components. But humor, fun, things being funny can be a component. Being very educational, wow, I learned a whole lot, can be one of those components. Another component can be something that's outrageous. Oh, my God, did you see that? Holy cow. Any of these things can be a component of causing something to be shared from one person to another. And it typically requires at least one of those components. And if you can have a bunch of the components, it helps even more. And one of my favorite examples, I've written about it a number of times, are the BlendTech videos. If you go to YouTube and type in "Will it blend?", you'll see some of these BlendTech videos. Basically, it's a small Utah blender manufacturer, and they've created a viral marketing sensation because they use their blenders to blend all kinds of weird and wacky things, like light bulbs and glow sticks and golf balls, and they even blend an iPod and an iPhone, all sorts of really interesting things. And one of the reasons that that's so successful is it combines a number of those elements that I just mentioned are some of the reasons why things tend to go viral. These videos, if you've ever seen them, and if you haven't, you should right away, either after the call or tomorrow, whatever, go to YouTube and type in "Will it blend?". These videos combine things that are remarkable, outrageous, and funny all in one, and it's perfect. And the other thing that's so remarkable about it, so great about it, is that these videos highlight their product really, really well. It's a blender they're selling, and they use the blender to do something interesting, and that people remember that. And I'm told from the folks at BlendTech that since they've done these videos, their sales of blenders in the consumer market have gone up fivefold. Can you imagine?
Wow. Wow.
By creating a viral marketing
wow.
campaign that is free. Didn't cost them anything to make the
wow.
videos. They put it on YouTube, and you know, they probably a small video camera was all they needed, and it's been seen by 50 or 60 or 70 million people, and it's
wow.
caused the sales of their product to go up like crazy.
Does viral marketing work for every product or service? That was one of the overwhelming out of the hundreds of questions that we got. That was one of the questions that came up most often. Does viral marketing work for every product or service? Does it work better for a product than it does a service?
I think that one of the things to think about when thinking about, you know, using this concept of viral marketing is that the real purpose is to spread ideas.
Yep.
And sometimes that can be associated with the product, like that BlendTech example is a great one. I mean, it is the product that they're highlighting. But it doesn't always have to be associated with an organization's products or services per se. It can be highlighting the fact that organization is good at something, or that organization has some very smart people, or has some really interesting ideas. So that what spreads is slightly removed from the product or service itself. So I'm going to be bold and say that I think virtually any organization or individual can create something that has potential to be shared by people, so has potential to go viral. I think that every organization, nonprofit, government agency, rock band, church, author, entrepreneur, you know, whatever, real estate agent, doesn't matter. I think everybody has the potential to create something that can be shared by other people online, one person to another. But I don't think that necessarily every single product or service necessarily lends itself to viral marketing. I do strongly feel, though, every organization and individual and company has something that they can create that can go viral.
Yeah. What about the professional versus amateur thought out there? Some people think that some of the best viral videos and viral content is created professionally. Other people think that that only the stuff that's done by amateurs goes viral. How have you seen that so far?
Well, one of the things I have noticed is that that a homemade kind of homegrown kind of feel is not a bad thing, and in fact can actually be a really good thing with this sort of content creating, this kind of marketing. Part of that is a backlash, I think, for all of the slick messages that all of us are exposed to on a regular basis.
Yep.
I mean, every day we're there, you know, watching television and getting exposed to all these TV advertisements, and we open the magazines and these slick advertisements, and you know that people are always marketing to us. You walk down, I fly a lot because I give a lot of I give speeches at a lot of conferences. I'm always in airports. I mean, you know, every 3 feet there's another advertisement that. Sitting
right.
there in the airports, and then you get on the airplane,
yep.
and there's advertising on the tray. We know where you fold down to eat your lunch. So so I think what people like is this homemade, homegrown kind of feel.
Yeah.
Now that's not to suggest, I don't think, that a professional look is necessarily not going to take off. For example, with my most recent ebook, and it's been downloaded 65,000 times so far in less than 2 months, with that ebook, I chose to spend money on a great design. So it is a little bit slick, but it's also, I guess, homemade in the sense that I made it. You're right. Some of the most popular YouTube videos have a herky-jerky kind of homemade, grainy, almost voyeuristic kind of feel. And that certainly hasn't harmed them, and in some cases I think helps to propel them, because it's almost anti-corporate, anti-high production values, in such a way that you know, that people are more inclined to perhaps take a look at it, thinking it's got some reality to it.
Yeah, do you think that has anything to do with different age groups, different economic groups, or anything like that, the ones that mostly backlash? Do you associate that with a younger crowd, or is that associated with a product or an industry?
I don't think that it's age-based at all. I do think that certain types of online media might have an age component to it, but I think in general all people are sort of looking for something that's going to be interesting to them, and are happy to have something that's been created by real people. You know, I think of two people in my family. I have a 14-year-old, she's just turned 15, I have a 15-year-old daughter. And she's constantly sharing things with her friends. She shares YouTube videos. She's always IMing and chatting and sending links to her friends. She's really, really active on Facebook. And they're sharing things all the time among themselves. And if you get something into that, you know, she's a freshman in high school, you get something into that sort of freshman in high school group, and if you're selling products to that group and you get them to start sharing that your ideas or your products or your services on their Facebook accounts, I mean, it can take off like wildfire. And then the other thing I think about is my dad, who's in his mid-70s, and, you know, he's always trading things back and forth with his friends. Now, he uses email, but, you know, he's in the sort of the dirty joke club, and they're sharing their dirty jokes back and forth, and they share funny pictures back and forth, and they share links to funny videos back and forth. So, in both cases, I mean, and they're wildly different in terms of their age and their and what they're about. You know, my father and my daughter, but both of them are sharing things with their friends online. My dad happens to use email, and my daughter happens to use Facebook and instant messaging to do it. But they're doing the same thing in a sense. They're sharing things that they find interesting with their friends.
Hmm. Speaking of sharing with your friends, another one of the questions that came up quite a lot was the fact that in your ebook and in other places in the blog that you've mentioned that that it's helpful if they go out and leave relevant comments on other blogs and other places to kind of help get a little buzz going. And one of the big questions was, how do you find time not only to blog, but to visit those other blogs and read relevant comments?
Right. Yeah. You know what? This question is one of the most common questions that I get when I'm talking to people, is how do you find the time, people say, to do all the stuff you're doing, David? You know, I have a blog, and typically I'll post twice a week. This week I happen, in the last sort of one-week period, I've only posted once, so I violate my own kind of unwritten rule of trying to post twice a week. And I do visit a number of blogs just to see what's going on. And I do something that's very important, and I think everybody should do this. It's critically important, which is I have a number of alerts on Google that I track. And I know whenever anybody has used my name or the title of my book in a blog post, I know about it virtually instantaneously as they write. What I'm doing is I'm literally in real time, I'll see if anybody has used my name or my book title, and I'll go visit the blog and find out what they're saying. And pretty often I'll comment, not always, but pretty often I'll comment if I feel like I can add something to what they've said. So if they say, oh, my God, David Scott's book sucks, and I'll say, well, thanks for buying it. Thanks for reading it. I'm disappointed that you didn't like it, but, you know, here's something that I found interesting as I was writing it and I was trying to convey it. And almost always, and it's very rare, actually, that someone takes the time to say something's bad. Happened a couple of times, I suppose. And almost always when I do that, it'll end up turning that negativity around in such a way that that person becomes a friend and or a fan because simply because I've taken the time to go visit their blog and leave a comment. More often than not, they'll comment positively about something I've written about, and I'll go in and I'll thank them and whatnot. And this usually helps to drive more interest in my ideas. The other thing, so I think everyone should do that. I think every person who's involved in helping to market their products and services or their company or entrepreneurs, everybody should be paying attention to what's being said and what people are talking about as it relates to your company, as it relates to you as an individual, as it relates to your products and services, and more broadly as it relates to your industry, your market, your geography, whatever's important for you, and you just do that by using one of the blog search engines like Google or Technorati or Ice Rocket or one of them, and monitoring on a regular basis. And you can do what I do, which is set up alerts in case someone says something you know about it right away. As you said earlier, one of the things that can be a really interesting trigger for getting your ideas out there is if you begin to leave comments on other people's blogs. So you're actually using other people's real estate, someone else's blog, as a way to introduce the readers of that blog as well as the blogger to your ideas just by commenting on what they've had to say. And you should never try to pitch your product. I mean, you know, don't say, hey, buy my product in your comment, but, you know, just say something, hey, this is interesting post. I've thought about it in this way. You know, leave your opinion, or, you know, that might work in the furniture business, but I'm in the car business, and this is how we look at it. You know, something that makes sense. And I think, Mike, isn't that how we got in contact?
Yes,
I'm almost positive you left a comment on my blog, and then I knew who you were. And at one point, I checked out your blog, and then at one point, one of us emailed the other, and we became virtual friends, right?
For quite a long time now, I think we have emailed back and forth, and like you, I have hundreds of virtual friends that I haven't met, but I do something that a lot of people don't do is I try to set up phone calls with some of the people so that we can interact with that voice and so you can hear the emotion and all that. Because sometimes text and email, you lose a little bit of that, you know, you don't know, like the sense of humor from someone who's in Boston like you are is a little different from someone that's south of the Mason-Dixon line of road like me, you know.
Right.
It's a little different. And once you've been able to establish a little rapport and contact with those people, you're able to dig a little deeper when you're leaving a comment on their blog, rather than trying to tiptoe around it, you're able to be a little bit more honest and open because you know the person will give you the benefit of the doubt if they don't understand exactly what you said. And people pitching through a comment rather than leaving a relevant comment and adding to the conversation is one of the keys that I think a lot of the, you know, big corporations seem to they want to join the blogging fray. And
right.
Now they want to join the viral marketing fray. But then when they see some of that stuff happening, they get scared and they don't understand. If someone's going to be talking about you, why not be in control of it and have it be on your blog?
Right. And I just find it so fascinating that, you know, that there's so many interesting bloggers out there. I mean, in virtually any topic, I don't care what business you're in or what product you're selling, what product or service, doesn't matter. There's interesting blogs out there on virtually any topic. And most bloggers, I mean, virtually every blogger that I've ever interacted with enjoys having people read their blog. I mean, why else would they do it, right? And they enjoy having people comment on their blogs or link to their blogs. And particularly when you've got some bloggers like, you know, like you're a good example, who have quite a bit of readers and people who follow them. I mean, you know, there's no better way to jumpstart a viral marketing initiative than to have a group of dedicated bloggers say, geez, you know, this guy's got some really interesting ideas. You should check it out. And the ebook that I put out about whatever it is, seven weeks ago now, is a remarkable example of that, because all I did was I published this ebook by putting it on my blog in the form of a blog post. That's it. I didn't email anyone with the URL. I didn't send a press release. I didn't talk to the mainstream media about it. I didn't dangle any advertising against it. All I did was post it on my blog. And then within a week, there were about 100 bloggers who had linked to it and said, hey, this is pretty interesting stuff. Check it out. And so, you know, part of those were people like you who knew me. Part of it were, some of them were people who had written about me before in some form or fashion. But some of them were, you know, two levels removed from me. In other words, I had never met them before. They had heard through another blogger about this ebook, and then they felt compelled to post it. And all of a sudden, I've got new people who are interested in the ideas that I write about. And imagine, if you will, how much that would cost. Remember, I've now got something like 65,000 downloads. Excuse me. Imagine how much it would cost using traditional marketing in the form of advertising, or traditional public relations in the form of trying to get people to write about your ideas. Imagine how much it would cost to get 65,000 people to pay attention to your idea. I mean, I know companies that would spend millions of dollars to get 65,000 people to pay attention to an idea. And here it is happening for free.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you mentioned that in the ebook or in one of the posts after that, that basically it was millions of dollars worth of free advertising, all because of giving away content and creating, it's kind of a long tail, but then again, it's also kind of a bunch of strategic alliances, because if you mentioned, let's say, seven different people in seven different industries using viral marketing in your ebook, theoretically, you could have talked to seven of those 65,000 bloggers. You could talk to seven different ones every week almost and put out another ebook every week, all because you've taken the time, rather than sitting and watching TV, to create rather than recreate, and that content.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. Create rather than recreate.
Yeah, feel free to use that. You can steal it. I don't need any credit for it. I probably stole it someplace myself.
A very good one, yeah.
But that's what it has amounted to, is you've created a following. But,
right.
But then again, you're also part of a following because you follow bloggers.
Right. And I will occasionally write about somebody and send them a link. Today is a good example. So today, I posted on my blog, which is Web Inc. now. I'm sure everyone knows that, but I posted on my blog about what I've seen recently around the ways that universities are starting to involve authors of the books that are being used in their courses, a chance to virtually participate in classes. And I've now done that with four different colleges, Auburn University, University of Georgia, Rider University, and Boston University, and other people have asked me, and I'll probably do some more as well. And the way it works is that either through a Facebook group or perhaps another social media tool, I can participate with the students as they're studying the new rules of marketing and PR using my book. And I've even participated as a guest lecturer via Skype or some other tool within their courses. And first of all, that's cool in itself, that the model of the way that an author of a book that's being used in a classroom at a university can now be a part of the discussion, virtually a part of discussions, is really cool. But I mean, some of the students at Boston University are getting ready to graduate. It's now March. They graduate in May. In 2 months, they need to find a job, and they're all looking for jobs now. And a couple of them have created interesting blogs or social, they call them social media resumes, and I linked to a couple of them today. And I've got a pretty popular blog, so maybe they'll get 5,000 or 10,000 links to their blogs as a result of me sending them a little link. I mean, that's it's just kind of a really interesting way for them maybe now to have a couple of companies who might be interested in talking to them as they're getting ready to graduate, just by virtue of them creating an interesting piece of content in the form of a blog or a virtual resume or something that I found, and I happened to throw them a link. It took me a minute to do that. And that may be the little piece of magic that will ultimately lead to them getting a job. I mean, how cool is that?
The good part is that it can turn right around and they get that job, and they're in a boardroom one day and the CEO says, "We need somebody to come in and talk to us about that," and they raise their hand and they remember David linking to them. And now they link back and say, "I know someone we can call."
Right, right, and that would certainly be cool, and that would be great. But I never expect that. It's always an added bonus. I think that one of the things that have been a bit of a problem on the web is so-called reciprocal links, where people have said, you know, if you send me a link, I'll send you a link, or people will, you know, one blogger will point to somebody's blog with the hope that, you know, that somebody will point back. And I always look at it as something in aggregate, where I like to link to people. I like to leave comments on other people's blogs. I've probably linked to 1,000 blogs over the course of the couple of years that I've been blogging. And over the course of the same period of time, something like 2,500 blogs have pointed to my blog. But I don't ever expect that it's kind of a reciprocal arrangement. And you're absolutely right that people who I point to may end up remembering that and providing at one point may end up being able to provide something that I want, which, you know, speaking engagement or something like that. But I look at it kind of in aggregate, that over the vast scheme of the internet, you know, you push a whole bunch of stuff out, sooner or later it will come back. I don't like the idea that people will expect or even demand that, "Oh my God, I linked to you. You better put it in your spreadsheet that at some point you have to get back to me." and I don't like at all those emails, and I'm sure you get them too, Mike, but those emails that come in that say, "Oh, hey, you know, I'm going to link to you. Please link to me back." It's like, well, no. As soon as you ask, you won't get it.
I've got a frequent flyer mile on my delete key, because I delete hundreds of those things a week, where people wanting things that it's all about them. Right. There's nothing in it for me, and
right.
they're not even nice about it.
Right. Right. Exactly. And the expectation that if they link to you, that you know that you're going to feel compelled to send it back.
Some of the things that do get linked to are things like we're creating right now, audio content,
yes,
video content, and you know what have you. Google is good, and they're getting better, but they're not great. And audio and video content doesn't get indexed as well as text does. And a lot of the people that sent in questions were concerned about that, and they wondered if they were wasting their time creating audio and video content because it doesn't get indexed as well. How do you feel about that?
That's an excellent question. So there are really smart people, much smarter than me, working on the problem of how can you index in a search engine audio content and video content. And one of the ways that people are experimenting with that is to use an automatic device that takes the audio and automatically creates a transcript in text, or the video or the audio part of the video and creates a transcript into text, and then that transcript is posted next to the video or audio content, which the search engines would then index. It's very rudimentary. It doesn't work very well yet, but there's smart people working on that problem. What I recommend, which is a hell of a lot easier than trying to do something like that, what I recommend to people is that if you're creating audio content and video content, is to create a companion piece of text content, and typically that's in the form of a blog. And so let's say one of the great forms of viral content is creating interviews like we're doing right now, and like you've done a bunch of these.
Yep.
And each interview ends up being its own unique piece of audio content. And then if you create either a blog where you talk about each piece of audio as you create it, or a website, and you say, hey, on this week's show, I'm going to have David Moon Scott. He's the author of New Rules of Marketing and PR, and this is what he does, and here's what we're going to talk about. Here are some of the questions we're going to ask. And you end up with four, five, or six paragraphs about that piece of audio content. And then from there, there's a link to the actual audio. All of the words and the phrases and the content that you wrote in text will get indexed by the search engines, and will drive people from Google and the other search engines to the text-based portion of the content, which will then, people will say, okay, great, I'm just going to click the button, and all of a sudden I've got the audio. So it's slightly convoluted, but it works because that blog or that website-based, text-based information will clearly be indexed by the search engines and will then drive people to either the audio or the video content.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, if you took a new tact and said each Wednesday I'm going to create a 17-minute audio, and all you wrote about it was the title and what you talked about, that little bit of text telling people what you were going to talk about would be enough to get them there to click on the player to listen to the MP3 of the audio. And there's so many people that are not textual, that don't read a lot, that love being able to click on an audio and listen to you talk about a subject rather than having to work by reading about the subject, that I think people are really overworking that and worrying about. They shouldn't worry about getting it indexed. They should worry about getting it created.
Right, right. And the other thing that's interesting about audio is that for people who travel a lot, it's often a preferred form of content. People who are often who commute by car. I mean, up here, and I don't know about down where you are, Mike, but up here where I live in Boston, some people have pretty long commutes. I mean, they'll be in their car for an hour each direction to and from work. And what a lot of people do is they have their podcasts get downloaded automatically throughout the week, and they end up with 5 or 10 or 20 shows a week that they like to listen to, download it onto their iPod, and they have an iPod interface in their car. And instead of, you know, listening to the radio or CDs or whatever, they're listening to people's podcasts, their audio content. I mean, I'm sure there's probably people who are going to do exactly that with the audio content we're creating right now.
Yep.
Don't want to listen to it necessarily live, don't want to listen to it necessarily off of their computer, but would be happy to download it as an MP3 file, stick it on their iPod or burn it onto a CD, whatever form it takes, and then listen to it in their car. There's another group of people who travel a lot on airplanes and trains, and the same thing, stick the content into a form that can be listened to while you have some downtime in traveling from one place to another.
I'll drive 200 to 350 miles a day, 4 or 5 days a week in between job sites. And if it weren't for podcasts, I believe I would go crazy listening to, you know, the same. I got Sirius Radio, and I've got satellite radio, but even you can only listen to the big 80s or the 70s or the 60s so many times before you start to hear those songs over and over and over again. And being able to listen to sometimes 18 or 20 different podcasts of, you know, 5 to 15 minutes apiece, it gets me through a week sometimes, you know, just by downloading all that onto my iPod one time.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more educational. There's no commercials, and I do have the ability to rewind and go over a point. And I get a lot of my blog posts that way by listening to, you know, two or three different podcasts and putting them together and putting my spin on it, how it would work for my industry, and coming up with it that way. So
right, and I'm hearing that same exact thing from a lot of other people. And in fact, you know, one of the things that I talk about a lot, we haven't talked about it yet today, but I talk a lot about what I call buyer personas, which is this concept of understanding who your buyers are in pretty great detail. And what we've learned through some buyer persona research is that certain job functions are more inclined to listen to podcasts than others, in particular salespeople. Salespeople, for whatever reason, the personality type is such that they happily will listen to audio-based information, but are less likely to read the same information. Little nuggets of information like that would suggest that if you wanted to create content that has a potential to be shared among salespeople, then you might want to consider that the right form of content to take for that purpose would be audio content or a podcast.
Yeah, I think most of us sales-oriented people, we're always looking for an edge. And if I can listen to, you know, 12 different podcasts, you know, in 2 hours in between one city and the next, between one job site and the next, and take that down, sometimes, you know, I'll listen for 2 hours, visit this job site and do whatever I need to do, and go right back and listen to that same 2 hours again to make sure that I didn't miss any of that. You know, I didn't miss that secret golden nugget that
yeah, right.
there
the,
for me. That's going
the
to
thing that's
going to
bring that next piece
of
business.
Century.
Right, right. Cool.
You know, with talking about audio, video, and textual content on blogs and stuff, have you seen any good applications of how to organize that on a website? Do they need to build just a media room or categories enough? Or when you go to a website, what do you look for?
Wow, that's another good question. I think that in my experience, the most important thing fundamentally to organizing content is to organize it either based on buyer personas or based on market problems. What I mean by that is if you go to most sites, and I'm only talking about websites here for a second, but if you go to most websites, they tend to be fairly egotistical in the way that they're organized. They're organized around what the company does or the company's product lines, and that might be okay for a certain group of people who know about your company and what its products are, but for a lot of people who've never heard of your company visiting for the first time, that's not going to be a good way to organize because they just don't know where to go. So what I always suggest is for people to think about how to organize content based on buyer persona or based on market problems. So as an example of how this works for buyer personas is if you think about the average hotel and the average hotel website, just think of a hotel in any city. The hotel basically it talks about their fluffy pillows and their tasty shrimp, and it's a generic one-size-fits-all website. But if you think about it from the perspective of buyer personas, there's lots of different types of buyers of hotel services. There's the independent business traveler who makes a decision about which hotel they're going to stay at when they go into a city. There's the corporate travel department of a company located near the hotel who needs to put people who are visiting the company into a hotel, and they might book as many as 100 or 200 or 300 room nights in a given year. And the person who makes that decision has very, very different needs than the independent business traveler who's making their own decision. Then you've got corporations and other groups who are planning to hold a meeting in the hotel, and they need to have a meeting room with AV equipment and a good lunch and whatnot. Perhaps you have a young couple who's planning on getting married and having their reception in the hotel, or a vacation traveler is bringing their family and wants to stay in the hotel. Every one of those different buyer personas has a completely different set of needs for the hotel, and a smart hotel website would be created based on buyer personas so that somebody visiting the hotel website for the first time can immediately click through to content that's designed especially for them. So I think in terms of a broad answer to the question around how to organize audio and video content, I think it's always good to organize it in such a way that people who are visiting you for the first time, that browsers are able to find it quickly and it makes sense. And one of the best ways to do that is to organize that content in the form of based on buyer personas. So if I click through, I'll see some content. Some might be audio, some might be video, some might be photographic images, text. And it'll be appropriately designed, especially for me as a buyer. The other thing, and you alluded to this earlier in your question, the other thing is I love the concept of what I call an online media room, which is a place where content that's designed it was originally designed as content for the media, but now has got use as well with anyone who's visiting a site who wants to know the latest about what's going on in that company will visit a company's online media room. So I think it also makes a lot of sense to post, and there's nothing wrong with multiple links pointing to the same content, to post the content on the online media room that says, you know, click here for our latest podcasts, click here for our latest videos, you know, click here for our latest press releases. Here's the places we've been quoted in the newspapers and magazines. Here's the places that we've appeared, that the analysts have written about what our company does.
That's a lot of content that people are creating. And one of the things we haven't talked about is the manpower or the womanpower associated with producing all of this. When you've visited and talked with and spoken to the corporations you've talked to, even though most of the distribution is free, producing all this content isn't. Can you offer up some advice to what you've seen that works and doesn't work for how companies allocate the funds and the manpower to try and create viral content?
Yeah, so often companies have focused on hiring people with the skills that were useful to be successful using what I alluded to earlier, the old rules of marketing. So companies have typically hired copywriters and people who are really good at creating advertising, people who are good at creating product-based messages and service-based messages. And typically, and we're talking about a little bit larger company here that would have a staff of marketing people in-house, typically companies have hired people with the skills of a traditional marketer, someone who's good at creating product messages and whatnot. If they're a little bit smaller, perhaps they rely on some agencies, and well, big companies do. People rely on agencies, and they'll hire agencies that are skilled in advertising, you know, advertising agencies. What I see working really well with all kinds of companies is to bring in, either by hiring directly or through a free on a freelance basis, bring in the skills of a journalist. To complement the skills of the marketer. So a journalist, someone who's got a background in journalism, maybe they were a newspaper reporter or an editor, perhaps they're even a broadcast television or radio reporter. People who have the skills of a journalist are able to craft an interesting story. They're able to understand who their audience is, and they're able to create content that's compelling and interesting, whether that's audio or video or text-based or photographic-based content. And so I found that companies who've literally said, all right, well, we're going to do marketing, but instead of doing marketing from a marketing perspective, let's do marketing from a journalistic perspective and literally create YouTube videos using people who've got the skills of a broadcast journalist, or create audio content with people in, working on it who have the skills of a radio producer, or creating text-based content with people who have the skills of a newspaper reporter. And that resource can be hired on a full-time basis or purchased on a freelance or part-time basis. And I found that to be very, very successful for companies because the content that they create tends to be something that has that little bit of extra spark that has the potential to go viral.
It's more remarkable, like we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sweeping generalization, but yeah, I mean, you know, they just have a little bit different sets of skills of, you know, they're literally those people were hired as, who were trained at school, if they went to journalism school, as creators of content. And that's what we're talking about. We've been talking about it for the last hour, is creating great content. So why not hire people who learned either on the job or at school or both to create great content, rather than people who have learned at school or on the job to create messages about products, which is what you know, what marketers are good at.
Yeah, seems to be that there would be a proliferation of those people out there available today too, as some of the mainstream media lays off people, whether it's USA Today or the New York Times or CNN. Or
yes, sadly that's true. I mean, you know, it's sad that mainstream media as a whole is laying off people, because there's been a contraction of a lot of different mainstream media properties. I mean, here in the Boston area where I live, the local newspaper, the Boston Globe, has shed reporters over the last decade or so. And absolutely, perhaps some of those make sense to consider bringing in. And you know, there is an availability of people who have those skills, and I think then it's possible for smart people who have a background in journalism to turn their difficult situation of losing a job in the newspaper, magazine, television, radio industry into something that has a potential to be an incredible win, which is to become, in a sense, the in-house journalist for a company. I mean, it takes someone with a little bit of a forward-thinking process to be able to make that leap, but certainly possible. And I know a number of people who have done it, and potential to have a really interesting and also potentially lucrative career by doing so. But it does require a little bit of a leap.
Yeah, one of the overwhelming questions that came in out of the hundreds we got was, how do I create that? I think we've given them a good idea now, is look for someone, even if it's on a freelance basis. And now you've actually even told them the type of person to look for that can get it in with a few strategic alliances. between those types of people. I think I think it's actually a little cottage industry that's ready to boom, but hasn't quite caught on yet, but it's probably just around the corner.
I do, too. I think there's a big potential in it. The other thing that's important for creating content, I alluded to this earlier, but make sure that the content is being created, the ebook, the podcast, the YouTube video, whatever it is the blog, is being created specifically for your buyer personas. You're creating content for the people that you're trying to reach, and you're addressing them as individuals, and you're addressing their needs and their problems, and you understand why they would be interested in your organization. Because too often what people do when they set out to create content that might have a chance to go viral is they focus on their stupid ass products and services. And, you know, it's just, you know, people don't care about your products and services. What they care about are themselves and the answers to their problems. And they also, by the way, want to be entertained a little bit along the way.
Yeah.
The combination of somebody who has some journalistic skills to create the content, or it doesn't have to be someone literally with journalistic skills. If they can at least apply the tools and the techniques that a good journalist can, together with content that's not created from your own egotistical perspective, but created from the perspective of the buyer, together with a little bit of fairy dust to create something that's funny, remarkable, interesting, outrageous. Those are the components of something that has potential to go viral.
I think you've given them a great business model there. Is there anything else coming down the pipeline in 2008 as far as viral marketing goes that you haven't had a chance to talk about yet, or that has come up since you wrote your ebook?
You know, I'm always looking for new and interesting stories, and I'm finding them all the time. And I take the time, if I can, to interview people whose stories I really like. One of the questions that you asked me earlier is that, you know, is it for all kinds of companies? And I just want to sort of close our conversation here. I wanted to share a little story that I spoke with someone today about, as a matter of fact. The guy's name is Tom Edwards, and Tom lives in Janesville, Wisconsin, and his local dog walking bit of woods near his house, where he's walked his dog. He's got a dog named Boo, who's a Saint Bernard. A German Shepherd. He walks every day Boo in this dog walking area in the town. One day he got there and he found out. There was a sign posted that said that the dog park, dog walking park, was going to be taken away by the city because they were going to build a new aquatic center there. And he started a grassroots viral marketing initiative to save the dog park. He created a website, and he got a virtual petition started. And he got his friends and neighbors to get involved, and what he was able to accomplish by doing this was he literally was able to save his dog park, which is remarkable to me. The URL to the site he built is called www.savethedogpark.com. He was written about on radio and television. He ended up with 500 people on his list of people who have signed the petition, and you know, so it just show. I think this, that sort of story, and I'm finding them all the time, are showing that this isn't just for big companies. It just isn't just for small companies. It's for anybody. And here's a guy who just wanted to save his dog park, and the way he did that is by using these tools that we talked about for the last hour.
You've given us a great hour of your time, David, and I thank you for it.
Well, thank you, for Mike, for setting it all up and for organizing the time together. Appreciate
it. Glad to do it. I want to apologize to everybody that might have tuned in a little earlier, right before I had to put us off for a couple of days. As you can probably tell, my voice is a little hoarse, and I'm trying to recover from the flu, and I certainly wasn't in any position on the day we had previously scheduled to try to talk coherently about such an important subject. And with a thought leader like you, I really wanted to try to do a good job. And I think we've done a pretty good job of further explaining what you started in your ebook. I hope that everybody that listens to this and through the replay or that was listening live takes advantage of it and does what we've been talking about and tells a friend about it, spreads it around, gives it somebody, because we'll have an MP3 replay up on the site within a few hours. And, again, I want to thank you. And have you got anything for us as you leave us?
No, I'm fascinated by the presidential election. And those people who might be listening on the replay, it's what are they calling this, mini Super Tuesday? There's the primaries are in Texas, Ohio, Vermont, and Rhode Island. And I'm just fascinated by the presidential election. I think there's some really interesting components of viral marketing used by some of the candidates, and certain things that go viral that they hope doesn't go viral will go viral. And so I'm kind of looking forward to going home and seeing what's going on with the election. But you know, anyone who's interested in focusing on what's going on with viral marketing, particularly if you live in the United States, should be thinking about and watching the entire presidential election cycle from now through November, because it's fascinating how many things are playing out online, and it can teach all of us, certainly me included, about what works and doesn't work in the form of viral.
Yeah, I think we could spend at least another hour talking about just political viral marketing.
Right.
We don't have time for it tonight. But again, I want to thank you for your time. I appreciate
Thanks again.
Everybody listening. And have a good night.
Take care.